I think I mentioned one time that when I'm preparing a sermon, I almost always start on a Monday. And Monday is just a time to read the scriptures over the three that we had today. A lot of times I will actually look at the collect to see if it has a theme that connects all of them together. And then Tuesday is when I begin to research. It's like an academic process. I want to know when this was written, who wrote it. And then a lot of times it will take me to other portions of the scripture. Where is this also mentioned and whatever? My problem, of course, is that when all that is done, I have too much. There's just absolutely no way that you can cover any of it. So you have to make a judgment about what is important and what do we talk about or think about or whatever. And so that's what I'll try to do this morning, is to neglect a large part and kind of condense it down. One of the things that I found myself doing, though, was with the gospel from Mark. You know, it's one of the synoptic gospels, and so the same passages are often in Luke and in Matthew. And I found myself going to Luke's gospel and looking at that passage and seeing kind of what was the context of that. And that got very interesting because it also then flipped back to Deuteronomy. And so I found myself, as I was reading Luke, realizing that Jesus's ministry is introduced by John the Baptist. And John the Baptist has become very popular. Jesus actually goes to him and is baptized by him. And there is like an interchange between the disciples of the two. They are not in competition with each other. They are in collaboration with each other. And at one point, as Jesus is beginning his ministry, the disciples of John come to him and they ask him, are you the one who is to come? Or should we keep looking for another? Jesus' response to the disciples is very interesting for me because he says, go back and tell John what you have seen and heard. And for me, that kind of summed it up. Go and tell John my relationship with people. Tell him what I am doing. Tell him that when there is a person who is in need, a person who is hurting, a person who has been ostracized, and that's what you're going to see, I don't have any problem with them. That's what my ministry is about. And so as the disciples go back to John, you know what they're going to tell him. By golly, he is. This is who we've been waiting for. This is who you have been talking about. And we are excited. And John will tell them, good, it's time for me to step down and you to pick up where he is at. For me, again, that's kind of a powerful thing, because when the disciples leave, then Jesus turns to his followers and he asks them about John the Baptist. And he asks them, what did you go out to see? And he gives them three options. And the first two are ridiculous, of course. He said, did you go out to see a reed shaken in the wind? He said, no. And they asked him, did you go out to see someone dressed in fine clothes? Well, we all know, we're like a camel's skin and whatever. He was the ultimate minimalist kind of thing. And Jesus is going to say, no, if you wanted to see fine clothes, you need to go to the palaces. You don't go out to the desert. And then he asks them, did you go out to see a prophet? And of course, everybody knew the answer to that. Yes, we went out to see a prophet. And Jesus said, you're right. He was a prophet, but more than a prophet. And so we come back to the theme today, and that is, what does it mean to be a prophet? And that kind of is what ties it all together, except for the second reading. What I love to do is to say to people, almost paraphrasing Jesus' question, why are you here? What did you come to see? Visitors, what brought you here this morning? And my conclusion would be, we're all here for the same reason. Brené Brown, my daughter's a Episcopal priest in Georgia, and she sent me the video of this sermon at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. last Sunday. Brené Brown was asked to preach, and they asked her, or she didn't, they didn't ask her, she said, there are three things, when I go to church on Sunday morning, there are three things that that resonate with me, that mean something to me. And of course, the first one, she said, I like to sing with people I've never sung with before. Well, that's a real compliment. The choir at Washington, D.C., of course, is famous, but so is yours. Why are you laughing? No. No, to sing with anybody, there is something about that. And she said, the second thing that I find very meaningful, that gives me focus and purpose, is the sign of peace. Because it is a recognition of our common humanity, that we are all in this together. And then she says that is reinforced by the third thing that is meaningful for me, and that's the communion rail, when we all come and we share together the body of Jesus. She goes on, and then she becomes theological, and she says the greatest enemy of the message of Jesus is our tendency to dehumanize our brothers and sisters. Boy, that you stop and think about that for a while. How often am I guilty of that? And dehumanizing happens in many, many ways. Whenever you think that someone is inferior to me or whatever. I tell people very honestly that my challenge in life is picking out two alternatives. One is competition and one is collaboration. And I'm very honest about that because I don't know why it is. I have a tendency to always, when I enter into something, who's the competition? Who am I competing against? Who do I have to measure myself against? And that's not good. That messes up more relationships and stuff. Even when I said St. Matthew's, so who are the surrounding parishes? What do we have to do better than them to get people? That's insane. And it's so much a direct contradiction of the message of Jesus. And so I would say, why am I here this morning? I am here because I'm still trying to move from that one position to this position. Who's going to win the Super Bowl? How many people don't care? No. It's a game. Boy, the people will kill you for, I mean, I was in New Orleans two Sundays before. What happened two Sundays before? The Saints lost in the last 10 seconds. If there had been Vikings, right? They lost to the Vikings. If there had been Viking fans, they would have killed them, I'm sure. There would have been riots and whatever, because these people are passionate about that. What a game, though, huh? If you could sit back and say, this is a game, these are great athletes, and I enjoy watching that. But my tendency, I couldn't say any of that in New Orleans, obviously, kind of thing. But seriously, the other thing that I would love to do is, again, we don't have time for it because there would be no annual meeting, but if we said, To go back to that question, why are you here? And second, can I have a show of hands? How many prophets do we have here? I knew that. That's it. Well, let's go to Deuteronomy. Moses, you're going to find a lot of the similarities that's in Deuteronomy. It's also in the book of Exodus. They're from a different source, but they're repeated, the Ten Commandments. Moses is ending his life. He knows he is not going to go into the promised land. God has told him this. He is on the one side of the Jordan River. On the other side is the promised land. Moses is now summing up a lot of the laws. Some of them are ridiculous, but that's okay. If you read it and you say, oh, I can't take this out of the time and whatever, but there's one in there where it says, if your son is rebellious and he won't take correction, what are you to do? You are to take him to the city gates. You are to stand him before the elders. And you are to tell the elders, my son won't listen to anything I say. He is a big problem. What are they to do? You don't want to know, do you? Yeah? They're to stone him to death. So that, So that, and then Moses says, so it'll be an example. Okay, if you take that out of the situation at that time, it makes no sense. If you put it into the situation, this is the same thing as treason. It is the same thing as if a person is deserting the army because they were going in to the promised land and they were going to be involved in battle. You cannot have a rebellious person as part of your forces. It's very clear. And so, like I said, it makes no sense to us now, but if you take it and go back into context, you say, oh, I see why. I trust they never did that because all you had to do was make the threat. Okay, but I got sidetracked there a lot. This morning, when I got the paper, I didn't have time to read it because I was on my way over here, but I glanced at the headlines of it, and it had the, have anybody seen the paper, the Orlando paper? It has the Floridian of the year. The Orlando Sentinel every year picks a person of the year. And then it was interesting because they picked a man I had never heard of, and I only was able to read the first couple paragraphs, but it seems like he started a food for hungry thing of preparing meals. And he took on as a project of organizing volunteers and sending over 4 million meals to Puerto Rico. And what struck me with that was I was one of the volunteers. I went with a group from St. Matthew's to the convention center where it was amazing, absolutely amazing. Had all this donated food. Of course, it had to be non-perishable. So you had a lot of protein bars, packaged things, and whatever. And they had assembly lines. And then the assembly lines, you packed them into the box. The box went in a bigger box, and the bigger box went on the pallet. The problem down there was that they were so efficient that the pallets were filling up. They couldn't bring the forklift in to move them because of all the people that were there, the response to that. For me, that was what this is all about here. It's recognizing a common humanity. And the other thing that I think really struck me was that I remembered back 1987, 88, when Hank and Kathy Collins were members of St. Matthew's, and they became the volunteer directors for Habitat of Humanity. They were picked as Floridians of the Year that year, the both of them. And they, of course, they drafted me. And I got to tell people, this is not bragging, but see, I was younger then. But I was also raised on the farm. I did the roofs for the second, I think, to the 10th or 12th house. We set the trusses and put on the sheeting, the shingles, everything. And I laugh because I go to the Habitat store. They have a little ladder. You're not allowed to get on it because of liability. I said, really? No, nobody ever warned me about liability when I was saying trusses. But that was such a powerful thing for me. And I can remember that there was a fundraising thing where ex-President Jimmy Carter was invited. He was doing a project in Miami. They invited him to come to Orlando and to speak. And they also invited the people that were going to get houses that were involved in this whole process. And the family that I got to know very well was Willie Franklin. And they asked me to give the invocation, the blessing or whatever, the prayer before. And I can remember I was sitting beside Jimmy Carter, and after the prayer, he kind of looked at me and he kind of nodded, because the prayer wasn't thanking the volunteers. It wasn't thanking Jimmy Carter for being there. It wasn't thanking the donors. It was thanking the people who wanted to make their lives better. It was thanking people like Willie Franklin, who wasn't perfect, nor were any of them. They were struggling. There was a lot of different things going on. But to them to step forward and say, I have a family, I want to make things better for my family. And Hank would say that. He said, the most important thing that you can do to a family, don't feed them. Give them a home. Give them a base. Give them a refrigeration and electricity so that they can do kind of things. And so those are prophets for me. And if you you look at Moses, he is saying there's going to be a prophet. Well, there were thousands of prophets. The whole middle section of the Bible is your major prophets and your minor prophets. Next week, you're going to hear from the prophet Isaiah. If you read Luke's gospel, this is the second instance of where Jesus has gone into a synagogue. The first one is in Nazareth. He goes in. He asks them for the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and he begins reading to them. The Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the poor and healing and whatever. And then he rolls up and he hands it back to him and he says, this prophecy is fulfilled this day in your hearing. What's their response? They want to kill him. We're going to take him out and throw him over. This is blasphemy. And I've been saying to myself, if there was any message that I would want to convey to you this morning is, if I were to say, how many of you are prophets, I'd want every hand in the air. Because somehow we have gotten it connected to the prophet is someone who tells the future. That is not it at all. It never has been. If you read the prophets are people who looked at their relationship with their God, not only as individuals, but as a group. And so if you're a member here, St. Peter the Fisherman, you are looking at your relationship with your God. You are a prophet. Any person that says, I'm going to take the time out, part of my priorities is to look at where I'm at and what I'm doing with my life and where I am going, you are a prophet. Now, when we go on to the gospel, Jesus, of course, is saying, he's very comfortable with being a prophet. Here's the issue that I have. Why don't we have a feast in our church year of Jesus the prophet? We have one of Christ the King, the one title Jesus did not want, the one title he tried to avoid at all costs because he was not a king. A king is something that is very different. And in one instance where he feeds the 5,000, they want to come and make him a king. Where is he? He's gone. He'll have no part of this. And I think that we would be a lot healthier as followers of Jesus, if I'd have said, I don't want to identify with the king. I want to identify with the prophet. A prophet who looks at his relationship with other people. I want to end the sermon there, but I just want to say to you, if you're frustrated by the second reading of Food to Idols, everybody is. I don't have time to go into it all, but very clearly I want to say there was an issue in the early church, and that is all the followers of Jesus were Jews. Plain and simple, every single one, 100%. Paul becomes a ministry. His ministry really is to the Gentiles, to the non-Jews. He comes back to Jerusalem, and he said, we need to clarify how we are going to accept Gentiles into being followers of Jesus. Do we ask them to become Jews? Basically, he's asking, do we say you have to abide by all of the Levitical laws and all of this stuff? What is the major one? Circumcision. Do we require these Gentiles to be circumcised to be followers of Jesus? The apostles meet, and at one point James stands up and he says, no. I mean, that's shocking. He said, no, we're not going to ask him to do any of that. We're not going to ask him circumcised. We are going to ask one thing, to abstain from meat that is blood, whatever, offered to idols, because it's too complicated and there must have been a lot of pagan worship or whatever. Paul seems to have forgotten that meeting. And he goes, and so he's writing to the people and saying, oh, I can do it if I want, because I know there's no idols and whatever. Basically, this here, just leave it with this. Don't scandalize people. It's even though you say, okay, I can handle this or whatever. I'll use that as an example really quick. When I was a Catholic priest, they had this, one of the rules was meat on Friday. You couldn't eat meat on Friday. Okay, so I'm here at New Smyrna, and there's a really good seafood restaurant. And so I'm going to go have lobster, shrimp, scallops,